You're on KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara. Welcome to Radio Causeway. I'm Pav.
I'm Tim. This is your weekly showcase, bringing you timely interviews and bridging your world of music.
Described as the world's largest physics machine, the Large Hadron Collider is perhaps the key to unlock some of the mysteries of the universe, including uncovering the elusive Higgs boson, aka the God particle. Here to speak with us on his research at CERN's Large Hadron Collider is UC Santa Barbara physics researcher Puneeth Kalavasi.
And in the second half of the show, we've got music from Gogol Bordello and Big Science. Stay tuned.
Good morning. You're on KCSB 91.9 FM. This is Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
I'm Pav.
Today, we've got a great show lined up for you. Here with us to speak about the Large Hadron Collider and the hunt for the God particle is UC Santa Barbara physics researcher Puneeth Kalavasi. Good morning, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me here. It's my pleasure.
So before we get too far into your own research, which we're going to do a lot of later, can you explain to the audience exactly what the Large Hadron Collider is?
Sure. It's a particle accelerator. It's actually the largest particle accelerator of its kind in the world. And what it is it's a machine that's about 100 meters underground on the border of France and Switzerland. And it's huge. It's about 25 kilometers around, and it accelerates protons to very, very high velocities, almost the speed of light, and then collides them. And then the point is to see basically what happens and to probe the fundamentals of matter.
So what exactly, so we're colliding hadrons. What's a hadron?
A hadron is, so what we're colliding actually are protons, and protons are a kind of hadron. A hadron is a name for a class of particles.
In that class, we've got quarks and some other things that might not have been uncovered, but suspect that they're there and waiting to find out.
Quarks. We've seen quarks before. I mean, protons are made up of quarks and gluons, and so. Those particles are something that are familiar with, but the point is to try and see what else is out there, because this is the highest energy accelerator that we've ever built, and so we're trying to see if there is anything more fundamental than quarks. If quarks are really the smallest thing, fundamental particle, or is there anything smaller?
And then there's top quarks. What exactly is the top quark in relation to other types of quarks? What are we talking about there?
Well, so there's six types of quarks. The everyday matter that we interact with is made out of two of them, the up and down quark. And so atoms are made out of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And electrons are, as far as we know, fundamental particles in the sense that there's nothing inside an electron. But protons and neutrons have these things called quarks inside them, quarks and gluons. And we think so far the quarks and gluons are fundamental, that there's nothing inside these particles. And protons and neutrons are made up of two kinds of quarks. It's called the up quark and the down quark, and gluons. But there are four other kinds of quarks, and we don't really interact with them. I mean, we don't see them in everyday matter like hydrogen atoms or oxygen atoms because they're heavier. And basically because they decay very quickly. They form these other particles. There are hundreds of different kinds of particles, and they form these particles that are very short-lived and decay. The top quark is the heaviest quark there is. It's actually really, it's an interesting particle because it's as heavy as a gold nucleus, which it doesn't seem like very heavy, but it's 175 times the mass of a proton, which is made up of three quarks. So, it's sort of special. It's much heavier than any other particle that we know of, and it was actually discovered near Chicago about 10 years ago, So we think it has a special place because it's so heavy.
There's a collider in Illinois, right? That's where it, what you're referring to.
Right.
Yeah. And the Hadron Collider is larger than that, and it's the great strength of it is the speed it can achieve, and also the energy. It's supposed to be more powerful than the collider in Illinois.
Right. Until about last year, the collider in Illinois near Chicago called the Tevatron, was the highest energy accelerator that we'd ever built. It could accelerate particles to what physicists measure energy in weird units. We call them TeV. So it could accelerate particles to collide particles at 2 TeV of energy. The LHC in Switzerland is 7 times stronger than that.
Well, why make the collider so big? It's 17 miles around circumference thereabouts. Why does it need to be so large and at the same time way underground?
So there are two sort of reasons for why it has to be really big. I mean, the way you accelerate these particles is they go around this ring, and every time they go around a ring, they get a little bit more energy. So you could make because these are really high energy, so they have to go around the ring many, many, many times. It has to be, you could make a very long accelerator, but it would have to be hundreds of miles long. But what's nice about a ring is you could have it just go around and around and around, and every time it goes around, give it a little bit of kick. So it takes a bit of time to accelerate these things to very high energies. But also, particles lose energy as they accelerate. And to keep them in a ring, you have to force them to go to turn, and every time they turn, they're technically accelerating a little bit, and every time they turn, they lose a little bit of energy. Now the tighter the turns, the more energy they lose. So if you make a very small circle, they lose all their energy. I mean, you accelerate them, and then they just lose the energy. So you have to make a very big circle so that the turning is very gradual.
Well, I want to now jump into the research that you're doing, particular at CERN. Can you explain a little bit about what you're doing specifically out there?
Yeah, so I'm working on the top quark that we talked about a little bit earlier. So what I'm trying to do basically is to see how often the top quark is created. Because the top quark is so heavy, it's very rare. When you collide these protons, most of the time nothing happens. They basically sort of bump into each other or just pass by each other. Once in a while, two protons actually hit each other, and they give you a spray of particles. And usually, that spray of particles isn't something that we're terribly interested in. These are, they're mostly up and down quarks and gluons, which we're already very familiar with, because we've seen they're in the proton. Very rarely they give heavier particles, and the reason is just because you need more energy to create the heavier particles. So a top quark, because it's so heavy, it's rare. And so I'm trying to measure how often these top quarks are produced in these proton collisions.
And within the last about 2 months, they've already started to observe some of these top quarks, correct? Now, what does it mean to observe them? Because as you've already suggested, they are so small. I mean, what do they look like? Or what kind of data are you working with?
Right. So, what's interesting is we don't actually observe the top quark itself. You observe, a lot of these heavy particles, they decay almost instantly into other particles, and then there's sort of a decay chain. So, the top quark decays into what's called a W boson and a B and a bottom quark, and then each of those particles actually decays to something else. For example, the W boson decays into an electron or which we're all very familiar with, and we know exactly how an electron should look, and we have these detectors that are designed to to look for an electron. And how we do that is it has a certain signature in the detector. So it leaves a certain amount of energy in a certain pattern in the detector. So we can tell that that was an electron. Or this other particle called the muon, which is a heavier cousin of the electron. We know how that interacts with our detector. So we really are measuring are the decay products of the top quark. And the top quark has an interesting signature. It decays into a lot of things, and we can look for these patterns in our detector, and then we can get a pretty good idea that that was a top quark and not some other kind of particle that decayed.
So if you're just tuning in, you're on Radio Causeway, and we're here with us speaking about Large Hadron Collider and the hunt for the God particle is UC Santa Barbara physics researcher Puneeth Kalavasi. We're going to be taking a quick music break. If you have any questions about the subject, you can call in when the music's playing. The music, or the phone number here is 805-893-2424. The song is by Big Science, 1,000 Years. You're on Radio Causeway.
Hi, Radio Land. This is Rob Wallace, author of Improvisation and the Making of American Literary Modernism. And you're listening to Radio Causeway with Pav and Tim on KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara.
Welcome back. We're on Radio Causeway and KCSB 91.9 FM. I'm Tim.
This is Pav.
Here with us speaking about the Large Hadron Collider and the hunt for the God particle, Higgs boson, is UC Santa Barbara physics researcher Puneeth Kalavasi. And welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So in the first half of the interview, we were talking about the top quark and your kind of research on that. And I gather that's part of the CMS experiment. But there are a few different experiments going on at the Hadron Collider, correct? What?
Yeah, there are four experiments in total. And I'm on one of them, CMS. There are three others called ATLAS, OHCB, and ALICE. And part of the reason to have so many experiments is that, you know, if one experiment sees something that's new or unexpected, then you can have another experiment. And, you know, if that experiment doesn't see it, then you know that it might have just been a mistake on the part of the scientists on that experiment to see who saw something, or the other experiment can confirm. And so two of the experiments, CMS and ATLAS, are sort of general purpose experiments that are just looking for anything new. And there are two others who are more specific and they're sort of a little bit smaller experiments. And they're looking for certain particles in certain kinds of physics.
What exactly are they investigating, the other two?
So the other two are LHCb, and they're focused on one kind of quark, the bottom quark. Mm-hmm. There's another experiment called ALICE, and the LHC actually not only collides protons, but also at some fraction of the time also collides lead ions. And so ALICE is designed to study what happens when these lead ions are collided.
Actually, I had a question about the lead ions. I mean, this is expected to generate temperatures, or the collision or the smashing of these lead ions is expected to create temperatures 100,000 times hotter than the core, than found at the core of the sun. And that's, I mean, that sounds really hot.
Yeah.
Is this something that you actually would feel in there? I mean, how does this not melt everything?
It's because it's actually, it's not a lot of heat. I mean, these are very small particles. And so at a very, very small amount of space, you get very high temperatures. So, I mean, it's like having, in a large room, having a very, very high heat source in the middle of the room. I mean, you're not going to ignite the whole room or something. It's like an incredibly small space that is that hot. It's not the whole experiment, for example, that is at that temperature.
So, before we get any further, what is this God particle, the Higgs boson? Why is it such a sought after event or particle to witness?
So I gotta be honest, physicists hate it when you call it the God particle, because it makes it sound sort of omnipotent or something. Mm-hmm. But it's special. I will grant it that it is special because it, without this part, so in the theory that we have of fundamental interactions called the standard model of particle physics, and it was sort of formulated in the 70s and it's worked really, really well. There are some problems, but in the beginning of this theory, none of the particles had a mass, and which we know is false because, you know, things are heavy and things have mass. But in the 80s, this guy, Higgs, he's a Scottish physicist, came up with a way to, quote-unquote, give particles mass. And it turned out that you had to introduce this particle called the Higgs boson. And the way that all particles interact with the Higgs boson, and the way all particles with mass, I should say, interact with the Higgs boson, and the way that they interact with the Higgs boson dictates how much mass they have. So, for example, the top quark, which is the heaviest one, interacts the strongest, which is why the top quark is the heaviest particle. And so it's sort of the key to understanding why all the particles have a certain mass, which is why it's so important.
And so you're also looking at dark matter, or looking for mm-hmm. evidence of dark matter.
Right.
How do those relate?
So dark matter is this, so we know that there's this thing called dark matter, right? Because we've looked, it's interesting because we've looked at the stars and galaxies and we see more mass out in the universe than we expect. And so physicists call this dark matter. And
not using usually optical, it's like radial devices, imaging.
Right, and the way it was discovered was galaxies actually spin. And if you assume a galaxy has a certain mass, it's a very simple relation between how fast it should spin and how much mass it has. But astronomers saw the galaxies were spinning at a different rate than they expected, and so they just gave. And so it would indicate that they had a higher mass, and so they just call this extra mass or matter dark matter. And it's interesting that we can connect the astronomy, which is these huge galaxies, to something so small at the OHC. And we hope that we can make dark matter. And there are these theories which, you know, like I said, the standard model, which is this model that we have that works almost pretty well, has some holes in it. And there are all these new theories that theorists have been coming up with.
Supersymmetry.
M theory. Right. And string theory. All these theories. And some of these theories have space for a particle that behaves like dark matter. Which basically, dark matter basically doesn't interact with normal matter, and so we're hoping that we can see the presence of this dark matter at the LHC.
So what exactly are you seeing? So when these collisions are happening, what is it that's being seen? I mean, there's some images online that people can see, computer recreations or something. But what exactly are you guys seeing?
You mean actually, like visually, like what are these images?
Sure. Yeah. And the sound too. I saw differing things about the sound that these high energy collisions are making as well.
Yeah, that's,
or no sound.
They don't. I think so. Okay, so what happens is, you know, these particles go through our detector, and they leave behind a signature, an electronic signature in detectors. I mean, and a lot of the detectors are like your digital camera. They have these little pieces of silicon, and every time a particle goes through, it knocks a bunch of electrons out of this piece of silicon, which is exactly how your digital camera works. When you open the shutter, light comes through and knocks some light out, some electrons out of the silicon. And what you're measuring really is the electrons that are knocked out, the signal, the electronic signal. And then, you know, of course, you can take that electronic signal and display it however you want, and display it as sort of a line through the detector. The sound, I think, I mean, it's sort of a neat trick. I mean, you can just take these signals and then do some signal processing. I guess I don't really know how they do it, but and you can just turn it into a sound. But the particles don't really make a sound as they go through the detector.
And so other than the sound, exactly what are you seeing? How is it displayed for you guys to see? Is it only in numbers? Are you guys looking at visual representations of it?
Yeah, we're looking at visual representations of it. I mean, it's really a picture of the detector. So, for example, our detectors are basically like onions. They're different layers. You know, they start with at the very center where the collision happens, and they're their concentric layers outside. And so a particle will go through these layers, and at each layer you basically have what we call hits. You can have a signal at each of these layers, and you can draw a line through these layers, and then you can visualize that in like the things that you're talking about, that the pictures that you've seen in the media. They're basically a cartoon of the detector and the particles going through them.
And then along that arc of the trajectory, you can see whatever the signature is, maybe changing, turning from one or
right.
Got it. As long as we're on data, I mean, it's pretty phenomenal the amount of information or data, raw data, being produced through these experiments. From what I've read, I mean, we're expect to be getting about 500 megabytes per second or 15 million gigabytes per year. How logistically, I mean, as a researcher, you know, either in Geneva or in any of the centers to which the information is being channeled, how do you work with that?
So going back to, for example, like the top quark, like I said, is very rare. And so the first level, what you have to do is you have to decide what is interesting when you have these collisions. And thankfully, most of the time, a lot of the stuff isn't interesting. But to get to the interesting stuff, the interesting events, you've got to collide a lot of protons. So what we do is we collide these protons 40 million times a second. And out of those, only about 100 events per second are interesting. And right, we get about, I think that's right, 15 petabytes, which is 15,000 it's 15 million gigabytes a year. And it's all distributed computing. So we have, you know, there's a big center at CERN with tens of thousands of computers, and each country that is contributing material and physicists has a computing center. So the U.S., I think, has at Chicago, there's a very big computing center. And so we're talking about thousands of computers. So when I work here at Santa Barbara, I'm really logging into computers at San Diego and Chicago and even at CERN.
Well, when in 2008, when the collider was turned on, there was an incident and it was forced to shut down for over a year. I want to combine this with the kind of a little bit of a hysteria that was out there when this was being built, and the fear that there would be black holes created, because you're trying to understand what happened in the beginning of the universe and when the Big Bang happened. You're going to create a black hole that's going to destroy the Earth. You're going to eat the Earth. So what happened when the power's gone up? And I don't think it's actually made it all the way full bore, right?
No, yeah. So what happened was with the magnet issue when there was a breakdown. This is an incredibly complex machine, right? So, I mean, it's like building a car and then expecting, like in your basement, and then expecting it to just work the first time. And so what happened was they were testing it out, and they were increasing the energy, and then it was just a problem, a simple connection, really, an electrical connection that was bad, and there was an explosion. But and the black hole thing. So it's actually interesting. There's the theory that you can make black holes at these accelerators came from a professor here at UCSB, and he had come up with a theory that assumed a lot of things that were unphysical, but he was just having fun. He came up with a theory and said, well, if you assume some things that in this theory that is not proved yet, in this very far-fetched theory, if you assume some parameters that aren't really very physical, you can make black holes. Now that would be sort of cool if we could, but everything that we know about black holes is that, so the kind of black holes that you would make would be incredibly small, and everything we know about black holes tells us that these very small black holes evaporate at like almost immediately, and they basically disappear. So it's not really dangerous, but that's assuming that we could make these black holes, and we really can't. And also, there's a counterpoint to that, which is there are these particles that are coming from the sun that hit the Earth's atmosphere at energies that are considerably higher than anything that we can make at the LHC. And so there are these collisions which are at much higher energies, and you know, we haven't, and the Earth is still here, we haven't made black holes. So it's sort of, you're right, it's mostly hysteria, and it's pretty unfounded.
Yeah.
Well, along the same lines of, theories or just popular misconceptions or anxieties, I was reading in Harper's from the July 2010 issue, in their Harper's Index, they had odds given by an online bookmaker that the Large Hadron Collider will confirm the existence of God, 100 to 1.
Well,
yeah. You want to lay bet?
I don't know how they're going to do that.
Is there any place where people can go online, check out interesting the experiments that are going on at the collider?
Yeah, if you go to www.cern.ch, there's a public page, and they've got some. There's actually very good, very basic. Introduction about the experiments and what we're trying to do.
So if you're just joining us, we're here speaking about the Large Hadron Collider and the hunt for the Higgs and among other things with UC Santa Barbara physics researcher Puneeth Kalavasi. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Dr. Aaron Sell from the Center for Evolutionary Psychology at UCSB. You're listening to Radio Causeway with Pav and Tim on KCSB 91.9 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome back to Radio Causeway. I'm Tim.
This is Pav.
So what you heard right there was a remix from Hot Chip, remixed by Bonnie Prince Billy, the track I Feel Bonnie. It's the remix of the I Feel Better song. They just released that for their tour with LCD Sound System. Before that, we had When Universes Collide by Gogo Bordello off his new album and produced by Rick Rubin. So big producer there, done a bunch of stuff. And then earlier in the show, Amy, thanks for calling in. Sorry we couldn't get you on the fly. But that was Big Science during the break with the song Thousand Years off their new EP, Skyscraper Sounds.
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious, and don't call me Shirley.
It is now time for Strange News. So I'll kick us off. Under Democracy in Action, reported by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, July 21st, Wisconsin law permits independent candidates' five-word statements to accompany their names on the ballot to signal voters, just as the words Republican and Democrat are signals. But Milwaukee Assembly candidate Aisha Griffin was ruled in July to have gone too far with her statement, not the white man's expletive. Her capitalization in anyways, Griffin said the decision baffled her since everyone she spoke with understood exactly what she meant. No. Yeah.
I don't know what would be wrong with that.
It's on my card. No, it's not. So.
Did you say your car or your card?
Either way.
Yeah.
Oh, good grief.
Exactly.
Warning, warning. Now it's your turn.
That was the trifecta right there.
I'm overwhelmed by all three of those. as long as we're on the topic of politics, this comes from the Dallas Morning News from mid-August. Texas State Representative Joe Driver, an 18-year House veteran, who on his website notes his opposition, and this is to quote him directly, big spending habits, and this is what he opposes, big spending habits of liberals in government. Well, Mr. Driver was revealed in August to have been routinely double billing the government for travel expenses and to have been genuinely surprised to learn that voters and colleagues might find that improper.
Nobody takes responsibility for anything.
Well, according to the Associated Press, Driver insists he thought the double billing was perfectly appropriate.
Of course.
Until he talked about it with the AP, that is.
It's
all systems are functional.
Until they're not.
Exactly. So it was when he was talking to the AP that he changed his mind, as he says, well, it doesn't sound appropriate now, if you bring it up that way. He was pretty miffed. I don't think I could quote him directly, but his week was ruined. For at least 5 years, by the way, Driver has been collecting from the government for expenses already reimbursed by his re-election campaign.
Go!
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we're going to get back into some music before we have to get out of here. You got something good for us?
I do indeed. Right now, by the way, we've got Brian Eno's Taking Tiger Mountain in the bed. But right now, coming up, it's going to be a Dirty Projector song, Temecula Sunrise, live at Other Music. This is from their expanded edition of Bitta Orca.
You're on Radio Causeway.
Hey, what up? This is C-Los and DJ Question Mark. You're listening to Radio Causeway with Pav and Tim on KCSB 91.9, Santa Barbara.
Welcome back to Radio Causeway. This is Pav.
I'm Tim.
You just heard I Go Away from MNDR, and starting off that was Temecula Sunrise from Dirty Projector's new or the expanded edition of Bitta Orca.
If you have just tuned in and missed the first part of the show, you missed an interview with UCSB physics researcher Puneet Kalavasi talking about his work at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. And you can find the podcast, links to the podcast, at kcsb.org, radiocausway.org, and you can subscribe on iTunes. Until next week, thanks for tuning in, everybody.
Take care.
Hi, this is your local cartoonist, Molly Kuhls, writer and illustrator of the children's book Under the Snape Tree, The Wamboozling of a Village. And you are listening to Radio Causeway with Pav and Tim on KCSB 91.9 FM Santa Barbara.
Radio Causeway is a presentation of KCSB Public Affairs. The opinions expressed were those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KCSB, the Associated Students, or the Regents of the University of California.
If you have a comment or wish to respond, please address correspondence to KCSB University Center, Room 3185A, University of California, Santa Barbara, California, 93106. This is KCSB 91.9 FM, Santa Barbara.